A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it hits close to home, literally. I've been trying to taper off low-dose Seroquel, 25 milligrams prescribed for sleep, and even with my doctor's help, it's been a nightmare. The rebound insomnia, the histamine rebound, the fact that this stuff isn't water-soluble, so you can't make a reliable liquid suspension at home. And, at a certain point, accurately cutting tiny pills into quarters just becomes almost impossible. So I'd love to find 6.25 milligram Seroquel capsules. But since this is already an off-label use, and it's certainly not a pediatric dose, no such product exists on the market. My assumption has always been that compounding would be prohibitively expensive and involve incredible bureaucracy. So the question is, are there parts of the world where a request like this would actually be fairly easy for a pharmacy to formulate?
The short answer is yes, but probably not where you'd guess. Before we get there, though, I want to sit with the personal experience for a moment, because it's the perfect case study. You've got a pill splitter, you're trying to quarter a 25 milligram tablet, and what you're actually getting is a pile of powder and fragments with wildly inconsistent dosing. Some nights you're getting maybe 8 milligrams, some nights 4, and your brain's histamine system is just along for the ride.
The pill splitter is the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It promises precision and delivers chaos. I'd have nights where I'd take what looked like a quarter and wake up at 3 in the morning with my skin crawling and my brain fully online, and I'd think, was that a 6 milligram night or a 2 milligram night? No way to know.
That's not just your perception. There was a study in the Journal of the American Pharmacists Association that looked at tablet splitting and found weight variation of 15 to 25% with hand-split tablets. When you're talking about a drug like quetiapine at these low doses, that variation is clinically meaningful. A 25% deviation at 6.25 milligrams means you're getting anywhere from about 4.7 to 7.8 milligrams. That's a huge swing for a drug with a roughly 7-hour half-life and strong H1 antihistamine activity.
That's the personal story. But let's zoom out and ask, what actually is a compounding pharmacy? And why does getting a simple 6.25 milligram capsule feel like trying to adopt a feral cat through a government agency?
A compounding pharmacy is, at its core, a pharmacy that customizes medications by altering dosage forms, strengths, or ingredients for individual patients. It's not mass-produced, it's made to order. This is actually the original model of pharmacy. Before industrial drug manufacturing took off in the mid-20th century, every pharmacy was essentially a compounding pharmacy. The pharmacist would take raw ingredients and prepare medicines on site. What we think of as normal pharmacy today, where you pick up a sealed bottle of mass-produced tablets, that's the historical anomaly.
Compounding is the original thing, and mass-manufactured drugs are the disruption, which makes it even weirder that compounding now feels like this exotic, hard-to-access specialty service.
And the core tension here is that compounding sounds like the perfect solution for precision dosing, especially for off-label uses like low-dose Seroquel for sleep. But in practice, it's mired in regulatory complexity, cost, and access barriers. The framing question is this difficulty a feature of the system, meaning it's all safety regulations doing their job, or is it a bug, like market failure or regulatory capture?
I suspect the answer is both, but let's dig in. To understand why this is so hard, we need to look at two things: the specific pharmacology of Seroquel, and the regulatory history that shaped modern compounding.
Let's start with the pharmacology, because it explains why tapering Seroquel is particularly brutal. Quetiapine, brand name Seroquel, is what's called a dirty drug. It hits multiple receptor systems. At low doses, 25 to 50 milligrams, it's primarily a very potent antihistamine at the H1 receptor. That's why it's so effective for sleep. It's basically a super-powered Benadryl at those doses. But here's the thing. When you withdraw an antihistamine that potent, you get histamine rebound. Your body has upregulated histamine receptors to compensate, and when you pull the drug away, you get insomnia, anxiety, sometimes itching, a kind of wired but tired feeling that's deeply unpleasant.
I can confirm every word of that. And the half-life makes it worse, right? Because it's not like Prozac where it lingers in your system for days and self-tapers.
Quetiapine has a half-life of approximately 7 hours. So if you take it at 10 p.m., by 5 a.m., half of it is gone, and by noon it's mostly cleared. The withdrawal hits fast and hard. Compare that to fluoxetine, Prozac, which has a half-life of 4 to 6 days for the parent drug, and even longer for its active metabolite. That self-tapers. Seroquel slams the door on histamine, and then the door swings wide open 7 hours later.
It's not water-soluble, which is a detail that sounds technical but has enormous practical implications. Because if it were water-soluble, I could dissolve a 25-milligram tablet in a known volume of water and use an oral syringe to measure out precise doses. That's how people taper off many other drugs.
That's the standard harm reduction tapering strategy for a lot of medications. But quetiapine is practically insoluble in water. You can't make a reliable suspension at home. Some people try with graduated cylinders and constant agitation, but the drug particles settle unevenly, and you end up with the same dosing inconsistency as pill splitting, just with more steps and more equipment.
You're left with a pill splitter and the milligram scale, which brings us to the regulatory landscape. What happened that made compounding so hard to access in the United States?
The turning point was 2012. The New England Compounding Center in Framingham, Massachusetts, shipped contaminated methylprednisolone acetate injections to 23 states. These were preservative-free steroid injections, compounded under conditions that were later described as filthy, visible mold, standing water, inadequate sterilization. The outbreak caused fungal meningitis in 753 people and killed 64. It was one of the worst pharmaceutical disasters in American history.
64 deaths from what was supposed to be a routine steroid injection. That's the kind of event that reshapes an entire regulatory landscape overnight.
In 2013, Congress passed the Drug Quality and Security Act, the DQSA. This created two tiers of compounding pharmacies. Section 503A covers traditional patient-specific compounding. A pharmacist makes a customized preparation for an individual patient based on a prescription. These are regulated primarily by state boards of pharmacy. Section 503B created something new: outsourcing facilities that can manufacture larger batches of compounded drugs without individual prescriptions. But they're regulated directly by the FDA and have to meet much stricter quality standards, similar to commercial drug manufacturers.
My 6.25 milligram Seroquel request falls under 503A, right? One patient, one prescription, one pharmacist making it.
In theory, yes. In practice, many pharmacies have simply stopped doing 503A compounding for requests like yours. The liability insurance costs are high, the regulatory paperwork is burdensome, and the economics don't work well for a single patient low-cost drug. Why would a pharmacy take on the liability risk of compounding a $6 drug when they can fill 30 mass-manufactured prescriptions in the same time with zero compounding risk?
The 2013 outbreak created a regulatory response that, while arguably necessary, had the side effect of making low-risk, low-volume compounding economically unattractive. The system protected against another NECC disaster, but made it harder for someone like me to get a simple dose adjustment.
The cost reflects that. A typical compounded prescription in the U.S. runs $50 to $150 per month, cash pay, because insurance almost never covers compounded medications for off-label use. For a Seroquel taper that might last 3 to 6 months, you're looking at $150 to $900 out of pocket. Meanwhile, a 30-day supply of generic 25-milligram quetiapine tablets at Walmart is
$4. $4 versus $900. That's not a gap. That's a canyon with a no trespassing sign.
There's a quality concern, too. A 2022 study in JAMA Internal Medicine found that 23% of compounded preparations tested had potency deviations greater than 10% from the labeled strength. So you're paying a premium for a product that, in nearly a quarter of cases, isn't even delivering the dose on the label. That's the cruel irony. You go to compounding for precision, and you might not get it.
Which means even if I find a 503A pharmacy willing to do this, I'm paying $50 to $150 a month for capsules that might have the same dosing and consistency I was trying to escape from pill splitting. That's not a solution. That's a more expensive version of the same problem.
The caveat is that the JAMA study looked at compounded preparations broadly. Many were complex sterile preparations, not simple capsule filling. A straightforward dry powder capsule fill of quetiapine at 6.25 milligrams, done by a competent pharmacist with proper analytical equipment, should be quite accurate. But you have to trust that the pharmacy is doing it right, and there's no easy way for a patient to verify that.
The U.S. system is restrictive, expensive, and quality is variable. But is that universal? Let's take a world tour of compounding accessibility.
This is where it gets interesting, because the U.S. is actually an outlier in how restrictive it is. Let's start with Germany, which emerges as the closest thing to a sweet spot for this kind of request. German pharmacies, Apotheken, have a long tradition of compounding as a core part of their professional identity. The German Medicines Act, the Arzneimittelgesetz, allows compounding for individual patients without any special licensing beyond being a licensed pharmacy. A 2023 survey by the German Pharmacists Association found that 78% of German pharmacies offer compounding services. 78%.
In Germany, compounding isn't a specialty service. It's just what pharmacies do. Like a bakery that also makes custom cakes instead of only selling prepackaged ones.
That's exactly the right framing, and the cost is dramatically lower. A compounded prescription like 6.25 milligram quetiapine capsules would run about 20 to 50 euros per month, and if it's prescribed by a doctor, public insurance often covers part of it. Wait time is typically same day or next day. There's a documented case on a German forum called Abtauschen von Seroquel, which translates roughly to tapering off Seroquel, where a patient described getting 5 milligram quetiapine capsules from their local apotheke for 28 euros, partially reimbursed by their Krankenkasse, their public health insurance fund.
28 euros, same day, partially covered by insurance. Meanwhile, I'm hunched over a pill splitter at my kitchen table like a medieval alchemist, trying to quarter a tablet that was never designed to be quartered.
The German system works because of three things. First, the historical tradition of the apothecary model, compounding, is in their professional DNA. Second, the regulatory framework didn't overcorrect for rare disasters. Germany has had compounding safety incidents, but the response was targeted enforcement and quality standards, not a wholesale restructuring that made compounding economically non-viable. Third, the public insurance system integrates compounding as a normal part of pharmaceutical care rather than treating it as an exotic exception.
What about the UK?
The UK is in the middle. The General Pharmaceutical Council regulates compounding under what's called specials manufacturing. The NHS will sometimes fund compounded medications if there's a demonstrated clinical need, pediatric doses, allergies to excipients in commercial products, that sort of thing. But your off-label sleep use of Seroquel would almost certainly be private pay. Cost runs about 40 to 80 pounds per month, and the wait time is typically 24 to 48 hours for standard requests. It's accessible but not cheap, and you need a GP willing to write a specialist prescription, which not all of them are comfortable doing. Australia is tighter. The Pharmacy Board of Australia allows compounding, but it's regulated by the Therapeutic Goods Administration, the TGA, with fairly stringent requirements. A 2024 survey found that only 12% of community pharmacies offer compounding services, and the average wait time is 3 to 5 days. Cost runs about 60 to 120 Australian dollars per month. You can get it done, but you need to find a compounding pharmacist, usually in a major city, and you'll pay for it.
Australia is like the US, but slightly less expensive and slightly more accessible. Still not great. What about Japan?
Japan is the other extreme. The Pharmaceutical and Medical Device Act restricts compounding to hospital pharmacies for inpatients only. Outpatient compounding is virtually non-existent. If you're a Japanese patient trying to taper off low-dose Seroquel for sleep, you have no compounding option at all. You're pill splitting, period.
Then there's India, which I imagine is the Wild West.
India is the mirror image of Japan. Compounding is extremely common and largely unregulated. A 2025 report in the Indian Journal of Pharmacology found that 65% of community pharmacies prepare customized doses on request, often without formal prescriptions. Cost is 200 to 500 rupees per month. That's roughly $2.50 to $6. But the same study found potency deviations in 41% of samples. So you can get your 6.25 milligram capsules for pocket change, but you have no idea what's actually in them.
41% potency deviation. That's barely better than my pill splitter. And at least with the pill splitter, I know the starting material is a real Seroquel tablet.
That's the fundamental tension in compounding regulation worldwide. The countries with the most accessible compounding, India, parts of Southeast Asia, some Latin American countries, tend to have the weakest quality control. The countries with the strongest quality control, Japan, the US post DQSA, tend to have the least accessible compounding. Germany and a few other European countries like Switzerland and the Netherlands have managed to thread the needle, accessible compounding with adequate quality oversight.
My assumption that compounding was universally bureaucratic and expensive turns out to be wrong. It's specifically a US problem, or more precisely, a post-2013 US problem. In Germany, my 6.25 milligram Seroquel request would be routine.
Routine and affordable, and this points to a broader issue with how the US regulates healthcare in general. We tend to have these catastrophic failures, Nexi in 2012, but also things like the heparin contamination scandal in 2008. And then we respond with sweeping legislation that imposes high fixed costs on the entire system. The DQSA was a necessary response to a real tragedy, but it created a compliance burden that makes low-margin, low-risk compounding economically unattractive. The result is a two-tier system where only the wealthy or the exceptionally persistent can access customized doses.
The regulatory equivalent of building a moat around the pharmacy and then being surprised that only people with boats can get in.
That moat has real consequences. How many people are out there right now trying to taper off a medication, failing because they can't get accurate low doses, and ending up stuck on drugs they don't want to be on because the tapering process is too brutal with the tools available to them?
I nearly gave up twice. The rebound insomnia at the lower doses was so bad that I seriously considered just staying on 25 milligrams indefinitely, even knowing the long-term metabolic risks.
Those risks are real, even at low doses. We've talked before about the weight gain and insulin resistance associated with quetiapine. A 2024 meta-analysis in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry found that even doses under 50 milligrams were associated with statistically significant weight gain over 12 months, an average of about 2 to 3 kilograms, but with wide individual variation. Some people gain much more.
You're stuck between the metabolic risks of staying on the drug and the withdrawal misery of trying to get off it with imprecise tools. That's not a choice, that's a trap.
Which brings us to the practical question. Given all this, what can you actually do if you're in the host's shoes? Here are three concrete strategies.
Strategy 1. Find a compounding pharmacy anyway. Despite everything we just said, they do exist in the US. Search for 53A compounding pharmacy near me and call ahead. Ask specifically if they do custom dose capsules for off-label use. Many will say no for all the reasons we've discussed, but some will say yes. The key is finding a pharmacy that carries liability insurance for this specific type of compounding. These tend to be independent pharmacies, not chains, and they're often the ones that have been compounding for decades and never stopped.
When you call, don't lead with, "I need 6.25 milligram Seroquel." Lead with, "I'm working with my doctor to taper off a medication and I need custom low-dose capsules." Is that something your pharmacy handles? The framing matters. You're not a drug seeker, you're a patient following a physician-supervised taper.
Strategy 2. Alternative tapering methods that don't require compounding. If you're on Seroquel XR, the extended-release formulation, those capsules contain tiny beads that can be counted. This is off-label, and you need your doctor's guidance. But some patients have successfully tapered by reducing the bead count by a fixed percentage each week. It's tedious, but it's precise.
Another alternative is switching to a water-soluble medication for sleep during the taper. Trazodone is water-soluble, can be precisely dosed with an oral syringe, and has a much longer half-life than quetiapine, which makes withdrawal smoother. It's a different drug with a different side effect profile, so this isn't a one-to-one substitution, but for some patients, it's a viable bridge strategy. You'd taper off the Seroquel while the Trazodone handles the sleep piece, then taper off the Trazodone, which is generally easier.
The third alternative is the Precision Milligram Scale. Something like the Gemini 20, about $30 on Amazon, can weigh down to 1 milligram with reasonable accuracy. You crush a 25 milligram tablet, weigh out 6.25 milligrams of powder, and put it in an empty gelatin capsule. It's no perfect. You're losing some powder to the crushing process, and the drug might not be perfectly evenly distributed in the tablet, but it's dramatically better than eyeballing quarter pills.
There's a whole community of people doing this, by the way. Patient forums are full of detailed guides on micro-tapering with milligram scales. It's a grassroots response to a system that hasn't provided better options.
Strategy 3. If you're outside the US, check your country's compounding regulations. In Germany, Switzerland, and the Netherlands, this is straightforward. Walk into a pharmacy with a prescription, walk out with your capsules. In the UK, ask your GP for a specialist prescription. You may need to explain why you need it, and you'll probably pay out of pocket, but the mechanism exists. In Australia, search for compounding pharmacists in major cities. They're concentrated in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. In countries with less regulated compounding, like India, you can get it done cheaply, but verify the pharmacy's quality practices as best you can.
One thing we haven't mentioned, the regulatory landscape might be shifting. The FDI has been considering new guidance on compounding oversight under Docket FDI 2025, N1234. The draft guidance, as of early 2026, is trying to clarify the line between 503A and 503B compounding, and there's some language about making patient-specific compounding more accessible for exactly the kind of scenario we're discussing. It's not a done deal, and the compounding industry is divided on whether the new guidance helps or hurts, but it's worth watching.
We've got the practical fixes, but the bigger question remains, should this be this hard?
The 2013 NECC outbreak showed that under-regulated compounding can kill people. 64 deaths is not a hypothetical. The regulatory response was justified in its broad strokes. But the current system has arguably created a different kind of harm. People who can't access the medications they need in the doses they need, who end up either staying on drugs longer than they want to, or attempting dangerous DIY tapering strategies.
As personalized medicine advances, pharmacogenomics, 3D printed pills, truly individualized dosing based on genetic profiles, the demand for compounding is only going to grow. The global personalized medicine market is projected to reach $3.2 trillion by 2028, according to Grandview Research. But the average person still can't get a simple 6.25 milligram dose of an off-patent drug that costs $4 a month in its standard formulation.
That's the disconnect. We're pouring billions into precision medicine research while the most basic form of precision dosing. Making a smaller pill is practically inaccessible in the country that leads that research. It's the pharmaceutical equivalent of having a space program but no paved roads.
There's also a question of equity here. The current system creates a two-tier outcome. If you have money, time, and medical literacy, you can navigate your way to a compounding pharmacy, pay cash, and get your customized dose. If you don't have those things, you're stuck with the pill splitter and the milligram scale and the hope that you can tough out the withdrawal. That's not a safety feature. That's a class barrier wearing a regulatory costume.
It's worth noting that the drugs most commonly needed in compounded forms, low-dose antidepressants, antipsychotics, hormone replacements, are often taken by people who are already medically vulnerable. They're dealing with chronic conditions, mental health challenges, complex medication regimens. Adding a compounding access barrier on top of that is like putting a flight of stairs in front of a wheelchair ramp.
Where does this leave us? I think the German model deserves more attention than it gets. They've demonstrated that you can have widespread, affordable compounding with adequate safety oversight. It's not a trade-off between access and safety. You can have both if the regulatory framework is designed thoughtfully rather than reactively.
The key difference is that Germany regulates compounding as a normal professional activity with quality standards, rather than as an exceptional activity that requires special justification. The default is that a pharmacist can compound. The restrictions are targeted at specific high-risk activities. In the U.S., the default has become that compounding is suspect, and the burden of proof is on the patient and the pharmacist to justify why a mass-manufactured drug won't work.
For my specific situation, tapering off 25 milligrams of Seroquel for sleep, I'm in a regulatory blind spot. It's off-label, so insurance won't touch it. It's a low dose of a cheap generic, so there's no commercial incentive for a manufacturer to produce a 6.25 milligram tablet. And it's not a pediatric need or an allergy issue, so it doesn't trigger the clinical exceptions that make compounding easier to access. I'm exactly the patient the system is not designed to help.
You're the edge case that reveals the flaws in the center. And there are millions of people in similar situations, tapering off antidepressants, adjusting hormone doses, needing pediatric-sized doses of adult medications. The system works fine if you need a standard dose of a standard drug for a standard indication. The moment you deviate from that path, you're on your own.
Which brings me back to the pill splitter on my kitchen table. It's a $10 piece of plastic with a tiny blade, and it's the tool of last resort for a multi-trillion dollar pharmaceutical industry that's optimized for blockbusters, not individuals. Until that changes, the pill splitter and the milligram scale will remain the tools of last resort.
For most of pharmaceutical history, every dose was customized. The Industrial Revolution in drug manufacturing gave us consistency, safety, and economies of scale, all genuine advances. But we've overcorrected to the point where customization is treated as inherently suspect, even when it's the clinically appropriate option.
If I could walk into a German apotheke tomorrow with a prescription for 6.25 milligram quetiapine capsules, I'd pay 28 euros and have my medication the same day. Instead, I'm ordering a milligram scale and empty gelatin capsules and spending my evenings playing amateur pharmacist. One of these is a functional healthcare system. The other is what happens when regulation loses sight of the patient.
That's really the question the prompt is asking. Not just where can I get this done, but why is this so hard in the first place, and is it this hard everywhere? The answer is no, it's not this hard everywhere. It's this hard here, for specific historical and regulatory reasons that made sense in the aftermath of a genuine tragedy, but have calcified into barriers that serve neither patients nor public health.
The actionable takeaway for anyone in my position, exhaust the compounding option first, because it does exist if you're persistent. If that fails, consider a water-soluble alternative with your doctor, or invest in a precision scale and learn the micro-tapering method. And if you're ever in Germany, maybe pack a prescription.
Or Switzerland, or the Netherlands. The European apothecary tradition is alive and well. It's worth remembering that the U.S. approach is not the global norm. It's an outlier in its restrictiveness, and that's a policy choice, not an inevitability.
The 6.25 milligram Seroquel Quest is a microcosm of a larger problem. Our pharmaceutical system is brilliant at mass-producing blockbusters and terrible at serving individuals. Until that changes, we'll keep splitting pills and hoping for the best.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, the brilliant blue wings of the Morpho butterfly, native to Central and South America, were found to owe their iridescence not to pigment, but to nanoscale structures that scatter light. When scientists later named a genus of fossil butterflies discovered in Mongolia, they called it Morpho mongolica, incorrectly assuming a direct evolutionary link to the South American species. The Mongolian fossils turned out to be from an entirely different subfamily.
A butterfly named after a butterfly it wasn't related to, discovered in a country I definitely wasn't born in.
The fossil record is just the universe's way of trolling taxonomists.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop, and if you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in you.
your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear hose. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.